You know, Don, we are fortunate.
Well,
heck yeah,
Scott. We're very fortunate.
We're fortunate to have some really cool partners.
True.
Partners that produce and manufacture products that you and I personally believe in. And one of those is Tailwind Nutrition. You know, they've been with us almost from the very beginning of this podcast. And so our friend Sunny Blendy turned us on to this. She's a nutritionist. She's an ultra runner. And she said, guys, you got to try this. And we've been addicts ever since.
You know, I've been doing a lot of reading about sodium. In fact, we have a guest coming up, Andy Du Bois, that we're going to really dig into what's the current thought on sodium. And we're going to learn some pretty cool things from him. And one of the takeaways, I believe, is going to be that it's not so much the sodium content in our blood, but it's that sodium that's rolling across the tongue. And that helps. We've heard of drinking pickle juice and some of these other crazy things, but they seem to really work. And Dr. Noakes talks about that kind of stuff. So it's legitimately, you know, vetted in its concepts. And, you know, Tailwind is savory, and it has that sodium that rolls across the back of the tongue. It's more than just what hits the gut. It's what goes across the palate. And that's what's so awesome about Tailwind.
So go to tailwindnutrition.com, or if you can't remember that, you could always go to our partners page, click on Tailwind Nutrition, and it takes you directly over there.
Congratulations to Erica Lindland, who just won Rio del Lago 100. That's the second time. Yeah,
yes.
The second time she's done it. And really, I think the secret to her success is that she is deep in the pages of Ultra Running Magazine.
I saw her run by me a couple times, and I have no idea how she stayed on the trail because she was carrying a magazine.
That's what I was going to ask, Scott. Was she carrying the magazine? When I saw her, she was reading some current literature, yeah.
It's a reference. She had one magazine in her hand and another one stuck in her shorts, in the back of her shorts, because she was not sure, you know, how she was reading and studying as she was going.
Well, there's a lot of good reasons to study. There's an Ask Ann Trayson column, which is what's on your mind, what can she solve for you as a trail runner, and just other great old articles that are pulled forward, some current articles that are challenging the thoughts within ultra running. Good stuff.
The race reports. I mean, that's what I initially subscribed to Ultra Running Magazine, is to see who's winning all these races. Where are all these races?
And it's nice that they have it in print form, because it would be very, very difficult to take your computer and carry it along the trail. So both in digital form and print form, Ultra Running Magazine, go directly to our partners page, click over, and bam, the deal for Ultra Running Magazine is what, Scott?
It's incredible, actually. It's $20 off the annual subscription, which brings your annual price for a full year is $29.95. The only way you can get it is to go to our webpage, click on the partners, then click on Ultra Running Magazine.
That's 10 issues delivered to your doorstep.
Dr. Romanoff, you're probably very experienced at professional interviews. This is not one of them.
Oh, come on. Don't put yourself down.
we are very casual. That's a good word.
Ashley, were you expecting a professional podcast?
No, I wasn't. Apparently not. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
And it was a miserable, miserable day.
All right.
All right.
Are we ready?
We're Sally.
She left this.
Is Sally doing push-ups?
Yeah, or putting her shoes on. Yeah. There she is.
Sally's doing push-ups.
Sally, get with the pro. Is she going to be prone for this thing? Sally.
Hey, my headphones don't have the little mic on them. Is that going to be okay if I just have this guy?
Yeah, it'll prioritize that one.
Okay, cool.
Hopefully.
Hey, Andy, what's your time? Because apparently Sally has all kinds of time based on what she's doing to us.
Sorry, let's get started.
We'll just go down the line.
All right, let's do it.
Sally, why don't you kick this thing off? Why don't you introduce, and then Scott, and then Andy, and then I'll go.
All right, welcome to another episode of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Sally McRae.
I am Scott War.
I'm Andy Jones Wilkins.
And I'm Don Freeman.
Well, and today,
we planned everything.
Wait, was I supposed to go?
Yeah, because you started. That's the rules. Go ahead, Scott.
No, I was going to say this is an exciting podcast because it's something that if you were to see the video, Don's arm is not only behind his back, it's twisted at about 360 degrees, and his wrist is near his skull because we've had to twist his arm to do this podcast. It's a podcast to talk about specifically a race that Don just completed and generally how that can benefit everybody that's listening to this podcast. So last Saturday, Don Freeman completed the Rio del Lago 100-mile race. This is second time or third time you've done Rio del Lago?
Fourth time.
Fourth time?
Yeah.
See, I didn't know you your entire life. But he completed it, and I'll just set the stage, and then we can start talking about this. You know, Don has been running. He's always in very good shape, and he's been keeping a very good base, although he did not have this on his calendar until Thursday afternoon before the race. And he called me up, actually sent me a text and said, "Hey, Scott, I need you to do me a favor. I need you to announce the finish at Rio del Lago." And I went, okay. What's going on? He said, "I think I'm going to run it."
I love it.
And that's where this whole story starts. So, Don, tell us a little bit about your training up to this point, to Thursday, 2 days before the race.
Let's pause. Let's pause there first.
Okay.
Because our listeners need to know, first of all, Don never talks about himself. So I am especially excited about this podcast because Don is always interviewing, always asking the questions. Even if you go and hang out with him, he just wants to hear about you. Doesn't talk about himself very much. So, Don, the whole podcast is me about you. Are you ready for that?
Well, I was just about to jump in. Timely you said that because during the arm twisting at about 320 degrees, I agreed because what happened here really wasn't about me, but really empowers others to get out there and do it. Because we talk a lot on this podcast about just managing yourself, managing effort, and staying in tune with what's going on during a race. And we have Andy Jones-Wilkins on and Sally McCray and Scott War, who've all done the 100-mile distance. We have Andy Jones-Wilkins and Sally McCray that have run up front, giving us a different perspective. But there's a lot of risk to run long and a lot of calculations that have to be made, a lot of decisions that need to be made. And that's where I think the value of this podcast is really about what happens out there and what can we do along the way to ensure a good outcome for us at the end. So that was my negotiation to do this podcast. Let's talk a little bit about what it takes to run 100 miles and what comes up against us and what can we do to solve it. Scott,
do you see what he's doing already?
You know, what I was going to say is Don doesn't like to talk about himself, so he's kind of played this a little bit, and he's decided if all I do is talk and I monopolize the discussion, we won't talk about me.
That's possible.
Hey, here's the thing that I would like to add to this. The thing that I would like to see is people that are listening may also have a bit of fear to go out and run, even a half marathon or a marathon or 50K. They may have a fear that, you know what, I don't think I can do this. And that's one of the things that I want from this podcast as an outcome is, you know what, really anybody can do this. If as long as you do some preparation or a lot of preparation, but then go into the race with a lot of discipline. And I think that it's possible.
So
we just need to get the facts here on your training though, because I think it was literally off the couch, man. So come on, tell us what it was.
Yeah.
This is the most fascinating part.
Yeah.
Well, so my last race was 2013 States, and it didn't go well, and I think it really broke me. I wasn't really excited about putting a bib on. I had such a miserable experience. Although it got completed, it wasn't a pretty sight. And I was so I kept a pretty decent base. I was running 15 miles was my longest run, really, guys, in the last year. And I was just one of those fall mornings that felt real good about mile 7, and I'm climbing up a hill, and Candace had been talking about a 200-mile distance. And I thought to myself, the only way a guy could or a gal could really do 200 miles is if they really slow it down. So I've been trying to run slow for the last couple of weeks. And And I was caught in that perfect moment when the sun's coming down and you're only 7 miles into a run and I'm running slow. And I thought, I bet I could run 100 miles like this. So I called up the race director, Julie Fengar, and I said, hey, Julie, I think I can run your race. And then I didn't know she put me in. I didn't really intend for her to put me in. But good friends do good things for good friends. And so turns out I was in the race. And then people knew I was in the race, and then I didn't want to really back down from the race. So
sorry,
I went
sorry about
dead.
That, Don.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks. So my training, to answer your question, AJW, is 15 miles is my longest run in the last year, and 1 to 3 times per week with the runs of 8 mile distance, and that's really all I had done. But I knew that if I could keep it low and keep it slow, and through all of these discussions that we have on this podcast about staying within yourself and making smart decisions and recognizing catastrophe but before it comes on you, I wanted to essentially do an experiment, prove to myself and maybe to some others that if you're just smart, you could do this thing. Because I failed miserably. I've slept on the side of a trail, people coming by me, just kicking me to see if I was alive. And I've done it without training now and have gone slow. And it can work both ways if you want it to.
You know, I will tell, I haven't done a lot of strategizing with Don on this before the race. But the one discussion that he and I had was exactly what he said. If I can stay at this slow rate, and the tool that he used, I think, is brilliant. And it's not something new. It's his heart rate monitor. He said, if I can keep my heart rate under this many beats per minute, it's different for everybody, I know that I can continue for a long time. And if it goes above that, I'm gonna have the restraint and the self-control slow down or to stop and get that heart rate under control. And I saw him at what was that? Right before Rattlesnake Bar, it's mile 40s, and he showed me his watch, and he said, "Scott, I'm doing it. If I'm keeping my heart rate right here, and if I go above, I'm slowing down, I'm stopping, and I've been able to do it, and I feel great, and it looked great." So, anyway, that's the setup that I have for you.
That's sweet. That is really sweet.
And so those numbers, just I'll tell you my numbers. You know, I stayed in the 125 to one. I tried to stay in the 130s, and if I went up to 145, I would really back it down till I got to 130 again. In fact, I when I hit 145 or 146, I would literally walk until I hit 120, and then I would go again. And I stayed in those zones because I knew my training was so minimal that if I broke out, there was no recovery, and that I was doomed. So I respected the distance. And I was concerned that maybe I wasn't respecting distance, because you know that what happens when you don't respect distance. It hammers you. It tells you that it is the master. And so I thought, you know, am I being arrogant and foolish and doing something that I shouldn't do and putting my nose and thumb to the distance? But I wasn't, because I really did keep that effort level down, because I would have died out there.
Mm-hmm. Don, how many hundreds have you done?
That was 9.
Okay. So, do you think that when you were out there, I know that you were focusing on heart rate, do you think that having had the experience of 900s, which is, that's a lot, that's awesome, do you think that was maybe one of the main reasons why you're able to finish that race, even on little training? Like, your body, did it settle in and know what to do, or...
Well, you know, and I'd like to get Andy's take on this too. I think there's a point where you've had experience, you've gone through it, you know where the pain is, you've felt that pain before, and you say, you know what, I've even on my good training and my lots of training and the things that you do by the book, it felt this awful. So I knew that I could make it through that, and I expected that, and I welcomed it. I said, well, I can do this. So yes, it was those experience and those times that helped me out a great deal. AJW, do you have some thoughts just on the mental side of pushing through some of those moments?
Well, I think every experience you have, whether it's in running or life, once you have that experience, you're better prepared for the next time you have that experience. So even if you're differently prepared, right? So maybe you ran 70 miles a week for your fifth 100, and now you ran 15 miles a week for this one. The experience of running the 100 is still there. And the fact that you have an accrued 800 miles of training behind you is only going to is only going to help and have it kick in. What I think you did that was so smart is you knew you went by the numbers, you knew exactly what you needed to do and stay below, and you were disciplined enough as soon as you saw it creep up into the 140s to get it right back down. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I think I remember doing in my prime having 132 was my magic number on my heart rate, and I did Rocky Raccoon and Hard Rock in the same year and kept the average heart rate for both races, dramatically different races, at 132. Hmm. And, you know, they were two of my best hundreds, aside from Western States, that I've ever had. So I think there's something to be said for that technique, whether you're doing 50 miles a week or 15 miles a week.
So the question I had for both Sally and for AJW, you know, you guys are front of the pack runners, and in many cases, you guys are going for the podium. Are you also, or can you also have the same strategy of managing that heart rate? And you, Andy, I think you just mentioned, mm-hmm. at least on those two races you did, or do you do it in sections? So the first 70 miles, I am going to do this heart rate, and then after that, that's when I'm going to ramp it up and just go balls out for the finish. Can I say balls out?
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. This totally. Is GRN.
Just checking.
I'll go first on that. I got in a routine of taking it at Western States, just taking my heart rate monitor off at Forest Hill. So mm-hmm. I just didn't want any, you know,
mile 68.
62. So
62. I'm sorry, 62.
Come on, Scott.
38 miles left. I know.
It felt like 68
yeah.
for me.
Yeah. So, you know, that's where the race starts. And I didn't want to be thinking and paying attention to numbers anymore, except the numbers of the people in front of me. But for those first 62 miles, I'd be right on, you know, whatever I had to do. And it would change in a hot year, right? You'd spike mm-hmm. a higher heart rate earlier. In a cooler year, you might stay under control. Sometimes you might get a little complacent, like in the middle of the day, you eat a bunch of food, your heart rate goes down, you push a little bit to get it back up. So it became kind of a game to me. And then I think it felt better at the end to not know what my heart rate was and just let it rip.
Okay, I just have to chirp in for the rest of us in the world that run. I don't think I've ever had to push my heart rate up. I just want to make that clear that if there's anybody listening and they heard Andy Jones-Wilkins say, you know, there's those times when you have to really push to get your heart rate up. I don't think that's normal.
Sally, did you have Sally? Some?
Yeah. You know, I have recently been a little bit more strict with heart rate training. Last year for Western States, I wasn't. What I did do, I'm really big on, like I'll train with it for a little bit and then I'll not train with it and try to see how well I do based on feel, and then I'll reintroduce it. But for Western States, I wanted to run the first 62 miles all just based on feel and effort. And then at Forest Hill is when I finally put on a Garmin watch, and that's when I was more like obsessed with my time and pushing there. Mm-hmm. So kind of flipped it. But now Ann has me doing a lot of heart rate training.
And Trayson. Ann Trayson yeah. is Sally's coach.
Yeah.
If you don't know.
And I want to add to that. I think that you have to be careful with perceived effort, especially in the beginning, because heck, mm-hmm. you're trained up for 100 miles. You've got yeah. this thing that you've been thinking about. Adrenaline's coming on. You've got the magic of the bib, and you've tapered. So you have 2 weeks of rested legs. And so yeah. what feels easy really is beyond where you should be effort-wise.
Mm-hmm. Right. And
that's why I put on one of my first thoughts of the discussion. As I was running, I was thinking, you know, if Scott really gets his way and twists my arm, and I was to do this, what were the topics I would talk about? And one of my favorite things is, you know, run that first 10 miles like you'd like to run the last 10. If you were mm-hmm. running that first 10 and you're moving along, you're saying, gosh, this is slow. Ask yourself, if this was the last 10, would I be happy with this pace? And quite frankly, I'd have been elated at the pace, and I was, you know, going quite slow. So I try to flip that. When you talk about flipping, Sally, flipping mm-hmm. that first 10 to the last 10 and really yeah. keeping that into context. Because guess what? It's the same clock. We're running with that same clock, whether it's the first 10 or last 10.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the yep. questions I have not asked Don, because I followed him and I didn't follow him on my feet, but I've talked to him about this. But the one question, Rio Del Lago changed courses this year, And the first 19 miles were along the American River bike path, which is a paved bike path for 19 miles and not a lot of hills. I want to know, what kind of discipline did it take not to go too fast on that flat paved stuff?
So let's start with this part. You know, we talked about, I said calculated risk in the beginning and picking the right course for this. I would not recommend to anybody to go out and do a mountain course or to go out and do
Hard Rock is their first.
Right. Or just, you know, on this 15-mile training stuff. I mean, that only could happen because the first part was flat and because it was a cool November day and because, you know, there was a lot of very favorable things, and I knew the course and I knew there were exits out for about any time for me. So, you know, it's you have to make a real calculation if you're going to go out and try to do something with minimal training. And there's no place like Western States, Hard Rock, Leadville, any of these, the Grinder, any of these race grindstone, any of these races that have a lot of elevation to them. You don't want to try this with minimal training because you'll get chewed up and hammered. So to your point, Scott, yeah, I kept it really, really easy, and it was a gift, that first piece, and I just kept really slow. And there, and even on a flat course like that, it was with the pavement, I was able to bank a little bit of time there, and I just kind of kept that in the reserve all the way through.
Did you have any rough moments within the race? I mean, how did you feel the second half, or, you know, usually the last 20 is kind of a grind, but...
You know, I kicked some rocks that I didn't know existed on that run. I was playing a bulldozer with my front toe and trying to move some rocks, and I heard some noises coming from my inside of my shoe, not the outside of my shoe. Oh, man. Yeah, there was some surprises for me, and those were some rough spots. But I just tried to keep some discipline and you know, keep moving efficiently.
How do you feel today?
Oh, I'm good. You know, I did a sports massage that next day. I got a hold of some recovery boots that, you know, pump from the bottom up top, those pneumatic boots, right? And so I did a lot of things that were just hopefully as smart as I did on the race. I did after the race that really helped me recover quick.
So overall, your body feel... Go ahead. Yeah. I was just...
You Sally, go. You got this.
Go ahead, Scott. No. AJW, you go, and then Sally.
Yes.
Don, nutrition. I mean, what was your thinking? Did you have a plan?
Well, you know, keep in mind that I decided to do this. I was announcing the front of the race, and so at the beginning of the race, the start. It's called a start, and. And at 3 o'clock, I really committed. I'm going to run this race. And so I didn't put a lot of planning like that into it, but I knew that I needed to feed myself along the way. And I used a Tailwind Nutrition through most of the race, but I needed to supplement with some solids. And I'll tell you, since the podcast really is about sharing information with other runners, I came across that.
It's about you, Don. Go on.
you know that organic Clif, the new squeeze food?
Oh, yeah, that stuff's good.
Oh, you know what? I've had it in my kitchen, and I went, yeah, it's pretty good. But if you have it at a aid station, and you've got 40 miles on you, that stuff is fantastic. And I could squeeze down two tubes of that stuff and put some good solid food in. It was very good tasting. All the flavors were good, and I really relied on that as a solid food source. And I only ate one quarter bite of one peanut butter and jelly sandwich the entire day and evening. That's the only solid chewable food I had. The rest was ingested, and I drank a lot, or squeezed a lot of those Clif foods into me.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, it is.
It settled well. You know, you could put two of those packages down and off you go. So really liked it.
AJW, I'd like to hear maybe some examples. You briefly touched on it, but maybe an example of where you have gone in with a very specific discipline plan and kept to it and the outcome, and maybe something where you went outside of that plan and what happened?
Yeah. Great question. I think the best disciplined, plan race I've run was 2007's Western States, where, you know, I had a couple of successful years, and we were coming out of the really hot year, and it was, shaping up to not be so hot in 2007. And there was, the field was a little bit open. Hal hadn't won. He won in 2007, but he hadn't won yet. Graham Cooper was there. Eric Skadden was there. A lot of the normal cast of characters from back in that time. And I realized I had to stick with my own plan, and honestly felt more exhilarated at the end of that race because I just wanted to, you know, back then my running was all about what place I was in, not really my time. And I just wanted to get into Michigan Bluff in 10th place. And so, you know, that meant I had to be like in the top 30 at Robinson Flat. And it worked. It worked perfectly. I think I was 29th place, and then I was 10th place at Michigan Bluff. And Shelley gave me the little piece of paper that said how everyone looked in front of me. Hmm. And I was able to kind of pick them off and really accelerate beyond my training from Green Gate in. I think that was my fastest Green Gate in split, even though it wasn't my fastest race split. You know, where the wheels came off a little bit, I have to say, was Leadville in 2009. I puke and have stomach problems about half of the hundreds I run, and it usually doesn't throw me off. But Leadville in 2009, it was my third hundred of the summer, so maybe that had something to do with it. But they got in my head a little bit because there was a helicopter crash 2 days before, and so they changed the course. And it actually made it longer, and you had to deal with making a decision about, you know, how many bottles you were going to carry between aid stations and just the kind of stuff that I hated, because the OCD part of me, you know, once I have a race plan, I just want to execute it. That's always been my strength. It's like, tell me what to do, eliminate the things that I can't control, you know, and control all the variables I can. And 2 days before the race, you know, they stopped, that was out of the picture, right? And it was like, Anton was really going after the record that year, and there were some of those front range guys really trained up for it, and it was going to be a great race. And my head just got knocked out of it right from the start. So that, I mean, I soldiered on and did fine. But when I look back on it, I was like, man, I would have done like 10 things differently. And the reason I didn't is because I was out of whack from the beginning.
How about you, Sally?
What?
same question. Well, tell us about a race that you have went in with a plan and executed the plan well, mm-hmm. and where you've gone in maybe not without a plan or with a plan and not executed well.
I would say, well, I wrote about this one last year. It was Run Rabbit Run. Gosh, I had two bad years at that race, actually. This is probably like the most helpful. I wrote about it on my website, but the first year I got disqualified because I got so terribly lost that I would have had to make up 23 miles to get back on course. So the race director said, you know, you we're not going to let you finish the race. My immediate reaction was I really wanted to blame them because the signage was really off. But at the end of the day, I should have, you know, carried a map or aid stations or, you know, whatever. That was my fault for not knowing the course well enough. So I was pretty heartbroken after that one. And then last year I had another bad go at it, that I was not prepared for. Was, I'm cold a lot, and I think, oh, did we lose Andy?
No, we're getting it back. I think he lost connection somewhere.
Oh, okay.
Keep going.
All right. Sorry. Anyway, I was not prepared for the cold, and I'm typically just cold a lot. Like, my hands and feet are always cold, and I get cold pretty easily. And I knew at the start of the race, I wasn't feeling too well. I thought it was just like a basic respiratory, very low grade infection, not a big deal. But I started the race, and it was sunny. It was in the high 60s. And by the time I got up the first climb, which was only about 4 miles in, I was pretty cold to the point where my hands and my wrists were locked up. So I got into the first aid station at the second aid station, mile 13, and I needed to get something out of my pack, and I had to have a volunteer undo the straps on my pack because I couldn't even move my wrists or my fingers anymore. I was so freezing. And I think at that point, I should have made the decision then because I knew I'd be seeing my crew in the next 6 miles. I should have asked for a jacket. I should have asked for gloves. Ultimately, I had to drop out of that race because it was borderline hypothermia. I ended up being wrapped up in a sleeping bag, a jacket. I had hot cocoa and I was sat by the fire and I shivered uncontrollably for over an hour until a truck came and drove down. There's like five of us waiting at this aid station. So, you know, I was really well trained. I was fit. I knew the course really well where all the aid stations were, and I was really ready to have a good race. But, you know, that side of it had nothing to do with my training. It was just, I wasn't smart. You know, I didn't take the gloves or the jacket when I should have. And I was not feeling well. I ended up going home and I stayed in bed for 3 days straight. I was pretty sick. So it was just a stubbornness on my part, which is something I always battle with. I think, oh, I'm tough enough. I can get through this. But, you know, it's the details that, you know, that really contribute to success many times. And I wanted to overlook the details and think that I could just kind of grit through it. Yeah,
you know, and I don't think you can always rely on toughness. I don't think that's a smart strategy. You have to be tough. You have to be tough, certainly, but
you need to be wise.
That is your fallback plan. Isn't the way to go?
Yeah. You know,
so one of the thoughts that I had of you know how to get through a long race, and especially if you haven't done all of the back work that you need to, and that is that. I tried to eliminate anything that was going to cause for complication, such as you talked about gear, having the right gear. You needed to stay comfortable. You've got to try to eliminate anything that's going to take you out of the happy zone or where you enjoy being.
Absolutely.
I changed, you know.
And I got to jump in here, Don.
What's that, Scott?
Plan any of that for that race.
You don't know.
You call me a couple times during the race,
out.
And you go, "Hey, I need another shirt. Can you bring a shirt to the next aid station?"
Yeah, that's called.
By the way, do you have a charge?
Yeah, I didn't ask
if I
for
can
it.
Borrow.
A
don't
charge?
Have a
what?
Headlamp, Freeman? No, but I do, but I just don't know where it is.
Okay, let me rephrase my comment. I didn't say when I was doing my planning. It could have been mid-race.
It could have been on the course, mile 30.
it was, in fact, at mile 30. But so the sun goes down a little bit earlier in the fall time, and you're sweating during the day. And so I changed armbands, changed shirt, and dried up so the evening would be a bit more comfortable. You know, why add to, why pile on all the things that are uncomfortable about enduring 100 miles when you don't have to? So I
want to know, how did that changing the shirt and the arm sleeves benefit you?
Well, heck, you're wet and it's the sun drops and it's starting to get cold out, and I didn't want to be cold. But when I changed the shirt, it made me. Hey, Sally, you're making me dizzy over there. What are you doing with that computer?
I was hoping you wouldn't see. I needed to put my
computer was about to die, so I was trying to find my battery.
Boy, I tell you, I had to close my eyes. So, hey, changing that shirt just took that complicating issue away, and I wasn't freezing because all those things add up, like the straw that breaks the camel's back. As many straws that I could keep off of this camel, the better. And so that's why I did.
So one thing that I noticed, Don at one aid station had asked for a new shirt and some new arm sleeves. And I could see that, you know, as he changed into those new arm sleeves and a new shirt, that there's a little bit more of a rejuvenation. Andy, how much does that
Sally's,
play?
Sally's trying to break the internet.
I'm sorry.
My turn. All right. Yeah. All right. Friday afternoon fun.
So those of you who are listening to the podcast, just ignore that.
Quick, tweet it out. Tweet it out.
I'm going to.
I'm going to. What just happened? Do you remember what the question was, AJW?
I don't.
Do you, Scott?
Yeah, I do.
So, all right, fire away one more time.
Fresh shirt, fresh arm sleeves, or maybe new socks, new shoes. How much does that play into your psyche or just making you feel better halfway through or three quarters of the way through a race? Do you have any tricks?
It's huge. If you decide to do it, if you need to do it, you'll do it and it'll feel good. I can think so fondly of changing my shoes at Telluride at Hard Rock in 2009. There weren't Hokas back then, and I changed into a pair of Asics gel Nimbus shoes after I'd been wearing little puny Sportivas all day. And it wasn't because I liked the shoes or I just wanted to feel something different. And as soon as I did, it was like, oh, okay, well, I can run these last 28 miles. No problem.
Yeah.
It was great. Other type of creature comforts that have worked for me are like comfort food, you know, macaroni and cheese, pierogies, things like that.
What's a pierogi?
It's like a potato ravioli. It's really good.
Oh, yeah, I've had that before.
Yeah,
you dip it in
soy sauce or something like that. Oh, it's great.
You serve those in the tap room, don't you, AJW, in your tap room?
Oh, yeah.
Instead of a bowl of peanuts.
It goes great with IPA.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure.
hey, speaking of the tap room, Andy, do you have what's your bar favor there? Do you have like pretzels or the peanuts that you can actually throw on the floor? How do you guys roll there at the tap room?
No, we don't have any of that stuff. It's just beer. We don't eat. It's no food. You have to go out. There's a food truck down the road. You can go. But no, it's beer only in the tap room.
So if we were talking about equivalent to a runner, you're a minimalist when it comes to the tap room. You're not a bunch of fancy gear hanging around or extra stuff. It's 5K running shorts and some
focus.
Absolutely. No drop bags in the tap room.
Good.
Hey, Sal, what's your favorite trick of the trade during a race? Is it changing socks? Is it changing a scrunchie in your hair? What is it?
A scrunchie?
Are scrunchies still?
I love that you use that word.
Are scrunchies still a viable term?
Yeah, you can still say scrunchie, but man, what a blast to the past! I love that.
I'm old.
By past, she means like 2 years ago.
No, I was excited. I bought some scrunchies for my daughter a few months ago, bright neon ones, and I put them in her hair when she runs. They're really cute. Anyway, tricks of the trade. What do I do throughout a race? You know, I don't think I've ever changed my shoes in a race. Maybe one race I did when I first started trail running because I thought you were supposed to. Mm-hmm. But I never change shoes or socks. I typically don't change clothes either. Let's see.
Did you powder your nose?
I don't. You know what? I'm really big. Okay, so Western States. I was my thing for Western States was keeping my body cool right from the start. So before the race even started, I went into the bathroom and I got my arm sleeves all wet and I got the bandana that I had around my neck. I made sure that was all soaked. And then when I hit the first aid station until pretty much the end of the race, I started shoving ice in my arm sleeves and down my sports bra for like the whole race. And I did not have any problems with heat. The year before that at Western States, I kind of did similar stuff and I didn't struggle with the heat. So maintaining the heat for me, that's always been a big focus of mine and it seemed to work pretty well.
Let's dig into that a little bit with the collective group here around this table, this
dig
virtual
into what?
Table.
Dig into what? Her sports bra?
No. This
whether or not ice actually works.
No, just identifying the risky areas. Heat is risk, you know. Effort is risk, and mm-hmm. what can you do on the front end with your own strategy, with your crew, with gear, whatever, to minimize those risks? And I think therein lies the number one thing that you can move from novice to veteran in this distance racing is knowing where the trouble is and recognizing when it's coming and what you need to do to solve it.
I got that one. You got it. You have a...
I wish people could watch this live.
It's time to put this on
TV. AKW just about hopped out of his seat.
Yeah. So what you got to do, the thing that people screw up on the most is they deviate from their plan. They spend weeks and weeks talking about with their crew and their wife and their friends, oh, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And, mm-hmm. and the minute something knocks them off, it all gets thrown out the window and they do something stupid, like, I don't know, something that's not part of the plan. And next thing you know, it just has a snowball effect. And by the end of the race, they're not doing anything according to their plan. And then they have like mental breakdowns and they start crying and the little issues become big issues and the big issues become like catastrophic issues. Mm-hmm. And I mean that seriously. If you want it, you could track some of these like severe rhabdo cases that have come up in the last few years. I'm sure it started with some little mistake that then became a medium sized mistake that then became a freaking huge mistake. And I see, the runners I coach, I push them hard to have a plan and stick with the plan. Now, there's stuff that happens. Your headlamp goes out. Okay, you know, your water bottle breaks. You know, well, you have backups for all that stuff. But if your plan is to, you know, get to this aid station and eat a certain number of calories or get to this aid station and switch from a pack to a handheld, but then you get there and you're like, I don't really feel like it. I'm not that hungry and this pack's feeling pretty good. You know, invariably, that's going to end up coming back to bite you later.
And there's a lot of comfort knowing that you're on your plan. You know, that's an anchor point to say, you know what, I'm on my plan. And if you deviate too much from the plan, multiple steps, I think of that snowball that you're talking about, AJW, and I could see in my mind's eye this small snowball all of a sudden becoming this giant globe coming down with arms and legs hanging out of it and packs and bottles spinning uncontrollably down the hill. And that's what happens to your race when you get too many, I'll just deal with that. Oh, I'll just move away from my original plan.
I think too, and I think it's important to balance out having a plan with also just being really good at troubleshooting and training yourself to be calm under pressure. And when things go south, because just like what AJW is saying, I've seen it, and with the athletes that I've coached, they'll freak out over something so small, or they make this massive, meticulous, every teeny tiny detail plan. It's so crazy, and to the point where that is what they hang on to. It's like their security blanket. And if one little thing is screwed up in that plan, then they drop out or they have this terrible race. And so I think it's good to plan your steps, plan how you want to do it, but also know, be aware that very likely there's a lot of things in your plan that aren't going to happen or you're going to feel a different way. And so how then do you respond? And if you are calm and, you know, you're good at troubleshooting and looking at your options and thinking even ahead of time, what are all the potential disasters that could happen, or how then will I respond? I think that we often overlook the mental training that is necessary for the longer races. And if you're only training your body and you've only written down on a piece of paper what it is that you would like to do, then you're going to have a tough time getting through the 100. But if you are considerate and you are thoughtful in the weeks leading up to the race, I'm truly training the mind to tackle any problem and to learn how to be calm under pressure, you're going to be able to grit through a lot of the tough spots.
Before Andy, you chirp in, I have a question for you. How do you do that when something goes awry Mm-hmm. How do you get back onto the plan?
I want to pick up on something Sally said first, if you don't mind.
That's fine.
And then I'm gonna,
that's a great question.
And I'm going to get you because I've got. But that's post-race discipline. One of the things I force my runners to do, because Shelley has forced me to do it, is within 48 hours of the race, write a report. It doesn't have to be published anywhere. I mean, we know, but literally, and especially if the race went well. Well, it's, you know, what about it? And push back on that person. It's best to have an interview. You know, I'd love it if someone sat down with me after that 2007 Western States and said, tell me about your race, and then pushed me with questions to get that stuff out. Oh, well, there was this time when I got there, you know, whatever. I think if you have a record, and we're talking if you want to be in this sport for years, you know, Don, you should do this, by the way. Someone should sit you down and walk you through your Rio experience so that the next time you try to run 100 on 15 miles a week, you can do it. You know what I'm saying? I mean that seriously. You know, when things go awry, Scott, you've got to have, like Sally said, you've got to have the strength of mind to troubleshoot it, to think on your feet, and to get back to where you're supposed to be as quickly as possible. I think I told you this story before about the time the guy at Devil's Thumb broke my bottle. He broke the top. He was screwing it back on, and he just broke it. And so I had to go down into the, it was at Last Chance. I had to go through the canyon with one bottle instead of two in a hot year. And I was like freaking out. But I tried to stay calm. By the time I got to the bottom, I just filled up at the thing and got back to the top, got a second bottle, and was good again. You've just got to have, and some people have it and some people don't. As Sally said, if you force yourself and even practice to make yourself deal with being under pressure, that when a pressure situation comes during the race, you'll be ready for it.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Sally.
I was just going to say, I think it's wise to have purposeful training runs that you do know, well, that you can put yourself under that kind of pressure.
Yeah.
The planned ones aren't as great as the unexpected, but, you know, sometimes I'll do long runs where I'll purposely have, you know, less food or less water, or maybe not bring everything that I usually do. And obviously it'll be like on a course that I'm familiar with and, you know, I keep it safe, but just letting your body feel, you know, what it is to be uncomfortable and that you don't have the things that are going to help you get through this stretch well. And the more that you do that, the more that you realize like, oh, wow, I am a little bit stronger than I thought I was and I can get through this. Or, wow, when I get to this situation, I'm going to do this and this and this. And understanding that many times our brain is sometimes our worst enemy in a race. And if we can just train our brain to be a little bit stronger during those dark times and know like, all right, I'm going to get out of this and it's going to be better. I think that we'd be able to move through a race a lot better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For sure.
I want to bring up a point that Sally brought up a bit ago because it was so good, that some people do get so stuck on their plan and so rigid on that plan that it can become self-defeating. That you have to be flexible and you have to be fluid and you have to recognize when that plan needs to be modified. And if you don't allow yourself to modify it, then you may not make it through. So we're talking about stay on plan. Don't get one or two steps away because you'll be in a snowball, you know, rolling down a mountain that you won't be able to recollect. But there are times that if you don't make those small navigational adjustments, you're not going to get to your endpoint. So we have to, and I guess that's part of the experience, or bring in a crew member if you haven't done something before and trusting in some good advice there along the trail. That's what makes for successful outcomes. I doubt, and I'll ask both of you, for me at least, I don't think anything has gone exactly as planned all the way through. Mm-hmm. There's always subtle adjustments that you have to make. Mm-hmm. What about you guys, your experience?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and answer that one. I think this one is kind of silly, but because I talk a lot about the mental side of training, of racing, that's just such an important thing to me. But what happened to me this past year in Western States, which I was not planning for, and it was so out of the blue. I was not expecting this, that it threw me out of my race in a different way. But my kids for the first time were at my Western States race, and my family typically doesn't go to my races. And one of the reasons why is I'm very, 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 very close to my children. They're my world. They're everything. And whenever I raced in the past, when my kids were little, they always had a hard time with mommy coming in and out of the aid station. And they're just, yeah. So I just get a little sensitive to that. But also, it's a long, long day. It's a long day to be out there. And, you know, because I like to be in and out of the aid stations within 20 or 30 seconds, it just, you know, I never really thought it was fair for them to be dragged around a long race. But this year I thought, man, it's a great race to spectate, and, you know, maybe I'll get to see him a little bit more, and it's an exciting weekend.
I know her.
So. Oh my God.
Look who just dropped in.
Hey.
Yeah. Yay. Oh my. Well, she knows this part of the story that I'm right about to tell. So
it just popped up on my thing. So did I decline?
Hey, everybody, it's no, Ann Trayson on the
Ann
show.
Ann Trayson is on our podcast now.
Hey, Ann, this is Trail Runner Nation podcast, and we're talking about race strategies, and Andy Jones-Wilkins, Sally McCray is here. Scott popped off, but as I was looking to get Scott on, I saw that you were on Skype. I thought, how fun would it be if Ann dropped into this conversation?
Like, what is going on here?
Good to see you, Ann.
Good to see you, Ann. So I was just telling a little story about Western States really quick. I'm almost done. So my surprise thing was I had said that, you know, my kids could be at Forest Hill. And then also there was two other spots, Highway 49 and then coming off of right before the finish line to run around the track. Well, unbeknownst to me, I'm coming into Michigan Bluff. I was running in with Nikki Kimball. We were having a good chat, and my kids are standing right there. And I was not expecting to see them at all, but I immediately, and I knew this would happen, I'm not planned on it, but I started crying. And I got all emotional. It's like, oh, Isaiah McKenzie. And I'm hugging them. I'm holding their hands. And Anne's standing there. And she's like, you need to get moving. You know? Time for a family reunion. You need to move, move, move. But looking back, it's like I spent the most time at that aid station. And I took a lot of time with my kids and being very distracted. And I was just very distracted in there, not really paying attention to what it was that I needed. And as I left, and I keep on looking back at my children, and so, you know, stuff like that, you know, we always talk about the unexpected of, you know, maybe it's a stomach going south or, you know, blisters. But for me, it's, you know, the mental side and the emotional side can absolutely totally take me out of the race. And it took me a while to kind of like get back into it once I hit the trail again. So.
Hey, Ann, we've been talking a little bit about plans and being able to deviate from your race plan and making sure you're flexible enough to allow yourself to go away from it, but still disciplined enough to stay with it. So we know that there's a fine line that we have to walk. And so on that discussion, let's talk a little bit about recognizing when you need to react. You've talked a lot, and we've quoted you on this podcast about the best ultra runners are problem solvers. And that goes, you know, around here as Ann Trayson's theory and thought process is best runners are problem solvers. So how do you recognize problems? What are some early indications that, hey, maybe I need more fluid. Hey, I need to slow down. Hey, I need some more fuel. I'll throw that to you, Andy, to start with. And then, and you can jump in if you'd be so kind, since you didn't even expect to be thrown into this race. Andy, how do you recognize stuff that's going south for you?
I got great advice when I first started in the sport in the mid-90s from Tom Nielsen, who many people know, great Southern California runner, been around a long, long time. And his advice was as soon as you, the slightest little thing, particularly with blisters, right? The slightest little feeling in your foot, the little pebble, take care of it right away. The slightest little, that little hint of a calf cramp that we all know so well, that means you probably need to take a hit of some salt or some more fluids. A little grumbling in the stomach. You don't just blow it off and say, it'll probably go away. You know, you jump on it right away. And actually, even in the midst of the race, just kind of do a body scan every 10, 15 minutes. How does my stomach feel? How does my head feel? How are my hip? What's my form like? I mean, we know your form's going to go to hell eventually, but you know, we're at mile 35. How are things going? I think that if you do that, you know, on the one hand, I love to talk about how we zone out and get into the flow when we're running and everything else. But sometimes in the course of a race, you have to be really scientific about it and just say, okay, how am I doing? And if there's something that I give myself a B minus or a C plus on, I got to get on that right away. And experience would suggest that if you get on it right away and you do, as Ann likes to preach, you know, if you solve those problems on the fly, you're going to be much better off.
Any thoughts on that, Ann?
Yeah, I always say you want to be in the now moment. And it's funny, I always thought I was kind of weird, but I guess Andy's been doing it all along too, where I have a mantra. And I ask myself, I have like a mantra I do every 15 minutes, like how are my toes, my arches, and I walk myself all the way up to my head. And that keeps me focused on if something's going wrong. Because if I go, well, you know, my middle toe's a little whatever, although I never really got blisters, but just for example, I have a piece of rock or something in there. Take care of it. Right. You do want to take care of it now.
You know what else? You know what else I did? I would assign my crew to do that to me. So I would roll in, you know, I would roll into Robinson Flat and they'd be like, how are your feet? How's your stomach? How's your head? How's, you know. And it would, you know, I'd say, obviously, oh, everything's fine. Don't worry about it. But, you know, with Shelley, she knows me so well, she'd look me in the eye and she would know if something wasn't well. And we would jump on it and figure it out right away.
Well, crew is also really important. You know, like, 'cause I was just pacing and crewing last weekend. And they're like, I'm drinking a lot. And the problem with the hydration packs, you think you are, and then you pick it up and you're like, well, it's full.
Right.
So, you know, to say, or whatever you're using, like, you say you're drinking, but your water bottles are like 80% full. That's not drinking, but say it in a way you can handle it, 'cause you don't want to be beaten down. But no, each one has kind of a list of things to say, and your pacers too. I mean, you know, the whole thing, should have pacers or not, but it's just having them constantly ask what you need is important, and how you're doing. It's important.
You know, if you have a rock at mile 40, that rock is not going to get any smaller.
Right.
It might move around a lot. And I've had them move around, hide for a bit, but yeah.
Pacer versus non-pacer. Go ahead, Ann.
No, the stomach issue, just trying to catch that early and trying to, you know, like cool off or back off a little bit is really critical, I think, in these hot, especially the hotter ultras.
Let's talk about pacer versus non-pacer. Have you guys run both ways?
Yeah.
Yeah.
For just hundreds or?
Oh, yeah. Well, any distance, doesn't matter. Just long race, pacer versus non-pacer.
Yeah. Well, Run Rabbit Run doesn't allow pacers. And Western States, I've used two pacers the last couple years. I'm not really sure what was really the focus of that question. What are you thinking? Like, do they hurt? Like, do they hurt our performance or are they an advantage?
Well, I think there's advantages both ways. I think that I like my autonomy. I like to be able to, you know, go when I want to go, walk when I want to walk, not feel like I'm obligated to move at a certain pace or do a certain thing. I kind of like the independence. Andy, you look like you have something to add.
Yeah. Here's where I come down on pacers. If you're in the competitive arena and everybody else has pacers, you'd be silly not to. However, I remember Matt Carpenter talking about why he didn't have a pacer at 2005 Leadville, and he said he didn't want to expend energy on another person. That's Carpenter, so you know, take it for what it's worth. But he felt like he wanted to be in such of his own zone that another person there would be a distraction from his energy. I think very clearly of two Vermonts in a row I did. I had an attitude about Vermont. Oh, you don't need a pacer because it finishes in the daylight. So the only reason you need a pacer is because it's dark, you know, so I won't have a pacer. And, you know, I ended up getting, I ended up not having the best race there. And the guy, two guys who passed me at the end, Joe Kulak and Lee Schmidt, you know, they had pacers. So the next year I was like, damn it, I'm going to have a pacer. And I won, you know, and I basically had the pacer there to basically make sure I didn't get complacent and lazy. So I've enjoyed both running with pacers. You know, some of my pacers are my best friends, too. You got to pick the right ones.
Yeah,
I believe I really feel strongly that it just because your friends and training partners might not necessarily mean you're good pacer runner combination.
Yeah.
And frankly, just because you're a good runner might not necessarily mean you're a good pacer, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think that people sometimes misunderstand that, especially if you're in the heat of a battle, you know, if it becomes about the pacer and not about the runner, you could get into trouble. But I think the experience of running 100 is remarkably different with or without a pacer. But I also think so too is being, you know, at the pointy end of the field and trying to win the race versus, you know, just trying to get through. So I would say to anybody who wants to really compete, it makes good sense to have a pacer.
Can I throw something in there?
And did yeah.
So I think what's really good about pacers is to teach people who haven't done 100 or get them to experience the run. So a lot of times, I guess, you know, it's like, especially if someone's out, if I'm working with someone and they want to do 100, I'm like, the best way is get one of your training partners that may be running that far and do a race with them, because you'll learn a lot. I mean, Sally was generous enough to let me drag some of my buddies to Cooper.
Oh, that was a huge glad bless. Now. Oh, my gosh.
But it's a great learning opportunity. So, you know, here we're all like, well, you know, but most people aren't going for the win. And it's a great way to share and allow them to experience what it might be to try 100, because it's definitely not for everyone. So, but that's just my – I was just talking to someone now, and she went out and was pacing someone at Rio del Lago and learned so much that I think it's really going to be good for her when she does her first 100.
Yeah, I think seeing it firsthand is critical, to see the some of the struggle and some overcoming some of the issues out there. I think pacing someone for your first 100, of getting out there and getting a little piece of it, a little taste of it, is probably a very, very smart thing to do before getting in your own 100.
Yeah, I think it's also very valuable to, like, volunteer at an aid station to see the different people coming in and how they're handling it, and learn from the people that are coming in, especially those later aid stations.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Sally, can I ask you a question? That Western States a couple of years ago, where you came back from the dead and got into the top 10. You had a pacer, didn't you?
I did.
Do you think that was a factor in your comeback?
Yeah, I do. I felt like, you know, he's paced me. Dave Daly was my pacer at Forest Hill. He was the first one I picked up. Before I both of the races the past 2 years, I've sat down at the pacers and I've just said, you know, first of all, I want to do well at this race regardless of how I'm feeling, so don't let me complain. Mm-hmm. I realize that there's going to be some amount of pain no matter what, you know, soreness or aching or a bad belly or something, but I know that I'm strong enough to get through pretty much anything. And so, but it would be great if you guys would never lose sight of that. Like, just don't coddle me. I hate to be coddled in a race. So when we started running, and actually Don and Scott were there and they helped tape up my knee, and then I took off, and Dave just basically told me, he's like, you know, Sally, you trained so hard for this race, and you know, I know you feel like you're so far off of the front pack, but you still have 38 miles. So he just started to talk to me. And then he told me, he's like, I don't want you to look at your watch. I just want you to stay with me. and we're going to get through, you know, the next 18 miles really well. And so he talked to me a lot. And at one point I said, you know, I really need to look at my watch. I don't even know what pace we're going. And we were going pretty fast. And I yelled at him. I was like, Dave, we're going like, it was like right when you hit the trail, but we were going like, not super fast, but it was like 7:45 as we hit the trail. And he's like, yeah. And you're doing it. So I know it's going to hurt, but you know, you got to dig deep. And so from then on, it was just, it was a state of mind. It was a mental change. You know, I know the taping seemed to help a little bit. I had taken some Tylenol too, but I hurt really bad that last 38 miles. But I think having Dave with me really helped me just get the focus back, because, you know, in a 100-mile race, you get drained physically and mentally. I mean, you start to forget the most simple things because you're just exhausted and highly focused. I mean, the race seems to go by so quick, and a lot of times it's because you're just so intense and so focused on every single thing you're doing. And so I was drained. I was trying to keep a good positive outlook, but I was hurting so bad. So I was like at war, and I felt like Dave just kind of talked me through that and kept me going to good pace. And he didn't let me ever complain if I started to. It was like, yeah, I know you need to keep on moving. And when I picked Colin up, my second pacer, he pretty much did the same thing and was, he's a little bit firmer than Dave is. And that's why I always have him as at the end. Like, he will not take any crap from me at all. And he was just like, you know, tell the pain to shut the F up and you need to continue running. So, that's kind of how I was able to push forward. It was just a recharge, a reset of the mind. And, yeah, I'm really, really grateful to have them to stick with me through that.
AJW, did you have something to add there? Because I saw you start to talk a minute ago, but I have a final, at least for me, thought that came from the trail from this last weekend.
Go ahead.
And this plays a bit to what Ann likes to talk about, is present time consciousness. You know, being there and present at that moment, and not looking at the overall enormous task at hand, thinking there's. Heck, it seemed like I was running forever this last week, and I was only at mile 40, and it's like, what the heck? How am I going to get to 100 when it seems like I've been running forever, and it's only mile 40? I mean, what's going to happen here? And that's the wrong perspective. What I needed to do to continue with a positive mental attitude was just stay where I was at and just execute on the vehicle I was in and just keep moving forward and not look too far out except right where I was standing. And that present time consciousness of watching your body, knowing where you're at, having confidence in your effort and abilities, and just enjoying the quest. And that was probably one of the things that was a takeaway for me in prior 100-mile stuff. Mm-hmm. Is just you can't look at the whole thing; you have to look at the now.
Hey Don, how important is it for you when you're running 100-milers to hook up? I know you did it a couple times with a few people where you ran some of the course with them. How does that help you maybe take mind off of stuff you shouldn't be thinking of and staying in the now?
Well, I want to hear everybody's comment on this because I think that's a good one. I enjoyed the people that I talked to. I really enjoyed the conversation. It was fulfilling, but If you gave me my choice, I would be solo the whole time. I don't like to be pulled a little bit, pushed a little bit. And I'm okay entertaining myself. I'm good on my own. And so, but I'll, you know, if anybody that's listening that I was running with, I really enjoyed their company. But I like being by
cover
myself.
Cover all the bases, John.
Yeah.
I like running with other people for about the first 70 miles. And then I want to just be in my own world and do my own thing and not really be bothered with anybody else. I mean, except for my pacer. But and typically, that's a time of the race that there's not a whole lot of camaraderie going on anyway. But nothing wrong with those first 70 miles, you know, as long as the pace is in keeping with what you want to do, you know, to just be tooling along with people and talk. Some of my fondest running memories have been running through the high country with people like Nikki Kimball and Megan Arbogast and Dave Terry back in the day. And I mean, those are memories that Tom Nielsen that I'm just going to have with me forever, because you're having this experience that's one of the most important days of your life every year, and to share it with people that you really love, there's no substitute to it. Once you get down to battle time, though, and you know, you go by Cal 2 or you go through Telluride or you go through Camp Ten Bear a second time or whatever that Rubicon is that I think mile 70 to 75 is, I think, at least for me, I put the social stuff aside at that point.
I love it when the Pacers
H-A-W, important.
How about when the Pacers have conversations and they're talking?
Yeah.
I've had times for that, and it's like they have...
AJW's quote, it's one of the most important days of your life every year. I'm going to dig into that. There's something there. I'm going to study that and break it down.
I was a little bit lucky in that regard. I admit it. I was lucky. So I got to have 10 greatest days of my life.
And the final for me is the rhythm. The rhythm, because we've talked about some of these things that allowed for a good day for me out there on the weekend was the things that we talk about on this podcast. And we've recently talked about rhythm, and I tried to stay in a rhythm of efficiency, a rhythm of cadence with my feet, a rhythm of breathing, a rhythm of steady work. And just the theme of rhythm, I think, can be really applied to the 100-mile distance. Any thoughts on rhythm with you guys?
Each one's different. It's at least talk for me, about that, 100-mile is different race. So, and that's why I liked it, because you just didn't know. So I don't think there was any rhythm. I wish I had had that, but I never had any rhythm. Maybe I'm because I'm not real good dancer or something.
I've always felt strongly about settling into the day.
Yep.
Before making any decision about whether it's a good day or a bad day or whether I'm feeling the rhythm or not. You know, I do think if you run races repeatedly, you know, like Ann has done and I have done, and now Sally's starting to establish a bit of a pattern, you know, it's invariable that there are rhythms through the years, and you'll say something like, God, I don't remember this aid station being so nice, or I don't remember the trail being so smooth here. And so you can get in a rhythm of familiarity. You know, to me, the single greatest section of trail in the world is the trail from the Devil's Thumb aid station to El Dorado Bridge. And I mean, I could run that section of trail every day for the rest of my life and it would never get old. In that direction, by the way.
Yeah, that's a good point.
How long did it take you to get into what you say, not get into the rhythm, but settle in? I think that's the word you use.
Yeah, I got you. How long does it take me to? I would, you know, for me, my general number is like 5 or 6 hours to feel as though the day has started, the sun's coming. And that's not just for Western states, it's for any 100-mile race. It's like that 5 or 6 hour, it's like a little bit more than a quarter of the race is over. And so you're into it. If you were freaked out about some injury during your taper, now you're not freaked out about it anymore. If you're worried about, you know, whether you're fit enough to, you know, climb or descend or, you know, so that 5 or 6 hours is a really great place. And then typically I would have a 10 or 12 hours of just blissful fun before the, you know, last 3 to 4 hours of hell.
Well, go ahead, Scott.
I can't hear him. What'd he say?
I can't hear Scott.
Yeah. No, Sally, Scott asked, for you to settle in. You're settling.
Oh, okay. You know, about the same. It takes me at least Yeah, probably like 3 or 4 hours. The last 2 years, it's always been Robinson Flat for me.
Yeah.
I feel like the first 20 miles that I can't, like, my legs feel like, I don't know how to describe it. Like my legs aren't totally there yet. Like almost like baby legs. I don't know how to say it. Cause I really do try to pay attention to my taper. And so my legs, they feel, I know that they're fresh, but they just, it just takes a while for them to warm up and really settle in. But once I hit Robinson Flat, I feel like, all right, like I've kind of found that groove, and I love that section anyway. But yeah, I think knowing that I'm going to feel that way in the beginning of the race, it also forces me to stay calm and run within myself and not, you know, go out too fast or too hard, because it, you know, even though my legs aren't feeling totally strong and warmed up yet at the beginning, I'm able to really think about, you know, there's a lot more racing. My thing that I told myself over and over again leading up to the race and during the race was, you know, I have a 38 mile race that I need to get to.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's no car, there's no transportation, and I have to jog 62 miles to get to that race. And I want to make sure that I arrive at the race in the best condition and that I'm ready to run hard. And when I got to Forest Hill, I mean, I felt so good. I was so ready to run hard. I put my Garmin on and I just said, all right, Dave, here we go. We're going to run this last 38 good and hard. And so, that helped. That was a good little strategy for last year.
Hey, Ann, how about you? How about settling into a race? Did you have any particular length of time similar to AJW and Sally?
I agree with Sally. I always felt I love the section. My favorite section is Robinson to the River. And I could, if I could have my dream, I'd do it every day. Of course, yeah. I can't, but that's just, so it would always just be hold on till I get to Robinson Flat, assess, enjoy that section, and then... I always said that for me, the race always started at the river. So, but you'd started getting kind of warmed up on the Kowloop. But now the first, because everyone's so amped at States too. If you're looking at someone like States or even Vermont, and everyone's like jumping around, and you just don't want to lose energy that way with all the nervousness. So it takes a while for everyone else's energy to kind of settle down too. So. It seems like after about 50K, everyone's a little calmer. How about that?
Yeah.
Your decaf coffee.
Good point. Well, there's a lot of pieces in a 100-mile race, much like a 100-piece jigsaw puzzle. And they all have to fit in the right place, and chaos happens when all of a sudden you lose track of some pieces. And I think having these guests on today, or these co-hosts on today, because everybody here is essentially a TRN co-host, has really helped bring some perspective and shared some wisdom and give us all confidence that, hey, it's doable. And even for the front runners like Ann and Andy and Sally, that they're thinking the same things we are. You know, they're monitoring pace. They're monitoring effort. They're looking at the heat. They're trying to create solutions for whatever's been thrown at them. And we all go through it. So I think a good conversation today on this topic. Any closing remarks from the group?
I'm just inspired by you, Don.
Except
I'm
for
really
you, Scott, because we can't hear your mic.
Don, I'm inspired by you. I think you've inspired a lot of runners.
Scott is silenced.
Yeah, look at him.
I got to agree with Sally. Don, what a way to go, man.
Yeah.
Here's to your next one.
Seriously. Yeah. Don't do any training, Don.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Ann came in late. She's probably thinking, what did Don do? Did he run to the moon? I mean, what in the heck happened? But no, I ran Rio without a kind of a from couch to Rio, and it was just all done just on execution of trying to stay within within zones and not overextending or putting myself into harm's way. And so it was just about race execution is where some of the discussion came from today. So that catches you up on anybody else that may have joined the podcast late.
Sorry for joining late. I just
Agent W.
Here and there you were. You popped up.
That was fun. I saw your icon there, and I said, what are the chances if we just hit that and we just brought her into this trail run if she'd join us for a bit?
Yeah, so everyone get on Skype and add Ann.
She's a trooper.
Yeah. Now it's accepting someone.
Ann's available.
Yeah. But no, I was at Rio. I was back there. What time did you finish, Don?
You can catch it.
Oh, sorry.
23:31.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
So sub 24 people.
You can catch Ann at Ask Ann at Ultra Running Magazine. She also does some coaching. You can find her there. Andy Jones Wilkins is standing behind the bar in the tap room, pouring up the IPA. He does not have any peanuts or pretzels for you. They are strictly pints only there. Notice the three P's. And Sally McCray, you can find her at where do we find you, Sally? She's all over Instagram, all over the trail, all over Twitter. She's coaching. She's wearing swooshes around town. So she's easy to find. And Scott and I, we're slogging down the trail right in the middle, probably not moving to the left when we're asked to. So go out and run.
Moss.